It's Michael Cathcart with you. Welcome to Books and Arts Daily here on RN. So what level of acting skill does it take to play James Bond?
Well, no, there's not much acting required playing heroes. Not much dialogue to say that my name is James or my name is Bond. James Bond. That's it. That's about the extent of it.
Yes, Roger Moore. He starred as James Bond more times than any other actor, and you'll meet him in the second half of this hour. Before that, one of our most gracious writers, Nick Jost, joins us with a series of really rich stories about China, or influenced by China in some way. And you'll meet Lena Dunham, the disarming New York writer behind the very candid TV series Girls. She's still in her 20s, but she's written her memoir. Well, let's set the scene for James Bond by talking first about pop art.
Teenage Mary said to Uncle Dave, I saw my soul must be saved. Gonna take a walk down Union Square. You never know where you're gonna find there. You gotta run, 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 run. Take the dragon too. Run, 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 run. James the devil you.
American rock group The Velvet Underground and Nico with Run Run Run, a track recorded in collaboration with the iconic pop artist Andy Warhol. Well, the pop revolution is back. This weekend, the Art Gallery of New South Wales unveils a new exhibition called Pop to Popism, which takes a look at pop art's legacy in Australia and abroad. We're all familiar with Warhol's famous celebrity prints, but how many of us could name an Australian artist associated with the pop art movement? Well, let's talk about that. Wayne Tunnicliffe is the head curator of Australian art at the Art Gallery of New South Wales, and he joins me now to discuss this new show. Wayne, welcome back.
Good morning, Michael. Good to be with you, and I really enjoyed that musical intro.
Yes, it's pumpy, wasn't it? You know, when I first read the name of the exhibition, I misread it. I thought it was called Pop to Popism. I thought it was...
There's no popery in my exhibition, I tell you.
Some kind of hardline sort of medieval Catholic movement. But I get it now. So what's...
I'm glad we've cleared that
up. We've sorted it out. So what's prompted this? Why are we taking a fresh look at pop art?
It really came about when I worked on the rehang of the Australian collection about 2.5 years ago, and I found all these works in our basement from the 1960s, and a lot of them hadn't been exhibited since then, and they really dealt with popular culture in a very direct way. I didn't know about these works before I found them. I got really interested in it, so I thought, let's have a look at Australian pop art. There were many more artists than I thought there would be, and let's put them into their international context and show them if they're peers from around the world.
All right, well, let's build that context now. So you better remind us what pop art was all about.
Well, it was a revolution. It really was in the late 50s and early 1960s when artists actually looked to the visual culture that surrounded people every day. So they looked for advertising, consumer products, television, which had just been introduced, mass media, and they drew a visual language from that and brought it into the art gallery and museum. And many people were horrified. They thought this was the end of high art as they knew it, and other people thought, well, great. This is the world we live in. Let's see that in our art museums.
Yeah, so you're thinking of Andy Warhol with the soup cans and Roy Lichtenstein with those big comic books,
absolutely. Absolutely. James Rosenquist painting on a billboard scale, all these things.
I mean, they were shocking at the time. You'd go into the art gallery and there was a big, a frame from a comic.
Yes,
something
yes.
You were used to, you know, reading in your bedroom, and suddenly there it was on the walls of an art gallery. It was sort of weird.
Absolutely. Well, and a giant image of Elvis. And Andy Warhol's Elvis images, they're 7 foot tall. So they're not just images. They're actually blowing up. And Lichtenstein, taking those comic books, he's exaggerating the scale of those as well. So they're really calling out for our attention. And it was shocking to people because the dominant art movement at that time was abstract expressionism, which was all about sort of self-containment and self-expression. It was very hermetic. So for these artists to put comic books in and celebrity images and say that's art, a lot of people found that hard to take. But these images remain really compelling now.
Well, abstract expressionism was also confronting for many viewers, wasn't it? Because it was about sort of paint and energy and art as art,
yeah.
Without sort of showing pictures of things. And suddenly here we are showing pictures that are not just pictures but illustrations is the word that
absolutely.
You'd use for a lot of it.
Absolutely. And pop art, it's interesting because it does actually continue in that history of realism in art. You can trace antecedents all the way back to the mid-19th century and Manet's painting everyday subjects as well. But, of course, their everyday subject is this world of reproduction, of illustration, of images which circulate around us. So they're not going out and painting something that's in front of them in the world. They're saying that this mass media now is our world. So that was pretty confronting too.
And is it saying this is our world and let's look at it critically? Is it a kind of critique of consumer culture, or is it a celebration of it?
No, that's an interesting question, and sometimes the jury's still out. I think early on it is more celebratory. I mean, the 1950s, after the Second World War period, when you've got this economic boom happening in much of the Western world, new consumer items seem to offer, you know, a wonderful future where things were easier in the home, cars are faster. In the mid-1960s, that changes when people start to realise they've been manipulated by advertising people, and that all these goods aren't necessarily going to add up to a better world. So pop does become quite critical.
It's interesting to me because in the 1960s, we think of popular culture as actually mounting a critique of capitalism. I mean, pop culture, yes. Pop music in particular is seen as kind of, you know, critiquing the Vietnam War and celebrating love and youth, yes, and the whole thing. And yet here you've got this movement that probably people who like that sort of pop music also embraced, but really it's a celebration of capitalism.
It's a celebration of capitalism early in the decade. By 1967-68, with that sort of rise of the global counterculture, pop does go down that trajectory as well.
But So what are we thinking about there?
Martha Rosler, for instance, her series The Home Beautiful, where she uses these Home Beautiful magazines and she collages the view out the windows of these beautiful interiors. She collages scenes of the Vietnam War. So she's literally trying to bring that war into people's homes and that level of aspirational middle classness. If that's a word. It possibly isn't, but
if popism is a word, middle classness can be a word.
Absolutely.
Wayne Tunnicliffe is with us this morning. He's the head curator of Australian art at the Art Gallery of New South Wales, and he's been having fun in the basement. He's discovered all these lovely examples of pop art. So what have you found in the basement?
Oh, we found some very interesting things. Very interesting things indeed. We found works mainly by Australian artists in our basement. So Peter Powditch, wonderful beach scenes, very sexy woman. Mike Brown, his really, really dynamic, energetic, sexy works from 1965, which he showed in Sydney. And he was prosecuted for obscenity for these paintings. Not only was he prosecuted, he was actually convicted and sentenced to 3 months in prison with hard labour.
Heavens above. So he served time.
He actually was reduced to a fine on appeal, but it was a 2-year appeal process. Okay. So these artists are actually pushing against the establishment with this work, but the establishment is pushing right back, particularly in Australia.
And so are you saying that the Australian pop art is somehow more raw or more painterly or something?
I think it is more raw. It's compared to American pop's very cool. English pop's quite painterly. Australian pop is painterly, but it's really energetic and fragmented and often very overtly sexual as well. Like, I think they know they're pushing those boundaries and they're celebrating the lives they're living, but they actually want to, like, you know, poke at the establishment and get a response, and boy, do they get it.
Now, another artist that you've featured in this contemporary exhibition, or this exhibition that you're doing now, is Jeff Koons, who's a contemporary American pop artist. Now, there's a retrospective, yes, of his work on at the moment at the Whitney Museum in New York, and it's really divided the critics because there, yes, always has been some feeling that perhaps it's all a big con job, a big practical joke. Jeff Koons, who's terribly photogenic, it has to be said. He's a very, very handsome man.
He is. He's a very marketable commodity himself. There's no question. I think that comment's interesting. I mean, people said that about Andy Warhol in the 1960s as well. You know, is he just a con man? Is he a fraud? He's turning art into big business. excuse me. And some people probably still think that. But I think Jeff Koons, like Andy Warhol, has a very astute take on contemporary commodity culture and celebrity culture. And he celebrates those successes. And he's incredibly successful. He actually owns the world record at the moment for the price for a work by living artists. So it might be a con, but people are prepared to pay a heck of a lot of money for that con at the same time.
Well, so, indeed they are. In fact, we're going to talk in a few weeks' time about that Jeff Koons exhibition. We'll have Norman Rosenthal on too. have a chat about that. Yeah, it'll be a good conversation, that one, wouldn't it? Now, let's come back to the Australians. Brett Whiteley is also in this group, is he?
He is in the group. We're showing The American Dream, which is the largest work he ever did. It's 22.3 metres long. And he painted it in New York after he moved there in 1967. He arrived in America and he was really horrified by what he found, actually. The recent assassinations of Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, the American War. So it's a very dystopian piece, but it's painted in quite a pop style. So he uses the flat, graphic, posterish nature. There's collage elements, there's references to contemporary events. So all those things from pop art. And I don't think, you know, Brett is not a pure pop artist by any means, but many artists in the 60s incorporate pop elements into their practice.
Didn't he make those matchsticks that are out in the garden outside your gallery?
Oh, he did, and they are very pure pop. And he actually designed those in the late 1960s, and they weren't made until much later, but the original model dates from that earlier period.
It's a haunting sort of work, isn't it? It's two matchsticks, one of which is just your standard matchstick, and the other one's a bit burnt, actually quite burnt. And they just stand side by side. I don't know what it means. The first time I saw it, I thought, well, that's ridiculous. And every time I see it now, I feel more and more affectionate towards it. It grows on you. I guess that's the point of this art.
Oh, I think it does. And with the Whiteley, I mean, you can read a lot into it. You can see this full match and this burnt match and think, well, there's life passing if you want to be philosophical. Or you could just think, well, I can light my cigarette with that one, I'll lit my cigarette with the other. And it is the 60s. Everyone smokes. So, but, you know, it's a big work and it really grabs your attention.
Now, we've only talked about blokes. Are there women in this exhibition?
There are women in this exhibition. We went out of our way to get as many women artists in as we could. And we've got them all through it. So people like Marisol in America, Nikita Saint-Phalle in France, Rosalind Drexler, Martha Rossler in America, Bridget McLean and Viv Binns in Australia. And they're making really interesting work and often quite proto-feminist work as well.
In what way? Describe something proto-feminist for us.
Absolutely. Well, Viv Binns, her exhibition in 1967 at Waters Gallery, where she included these sort of very sexually explicit images, a big painting of a phallus sprouting flowers and another painting of a vagina with exuberant colours around it. And these works just brought the critics to their knees. Critics actually said this will be the end of civilization as we know it. Seeing a woman actually celebrate sexuality and from a woman's perspective.
Well, once a fella starts sprouting flowers, you know the world is over.
Yeah. And they're pretty jolly flowers as well.
Are they indeed?
But interestingly, the American critic Lucy Lippard, when she came out in 1975, saw these works and said, these are amazing. There was nothing like this happening in America in 1967.
This element that you've already spoken about, this sexually explicit quality in the Australian work, is that going to raise any eyebrows with the current exhibition? Is there a possibility of, the law being interested in what you're showing?
Well, I hope we've moved on from that moment in 1965 when people were prosecuted for it. I certainly hope so. I mean, I think the works are the celebratory of sexual freedom, which, of course, is relatively new in the 1960s. I'm not saying people hadn't had sex before that, but, of course, with the pill arriving in the early 60s, people are free to experiment, and some people do, and that's reflected in the art. So I hope people see it as being a celebration of an essential part of human nature.
When you were putting this together, did you ask the lawyers what they thought?
No. I try and get the lawyers out of it as much as possible. And I like to think in an art gallery, we can just get away with a few things. It's art after all.
That's right. If you can't get away with a phallus with flowers coming out with an art gallery, where can you get away with it?
Exactly, Michael. With you on that one.
Good on you, Wayne. We're shoulder to shoulder. Well, it's been lovely to talk to you. All the best. I hope I get to Sydney to see this. It sounds like lots of fun. It's been good to talk.
Yeah, no, please come up and see. It'd be great if you did.
Wayne Tunnicliffe, he's the head curator of Australian art at the Art Gallery of New South Wales. So that exhibition is called Pop to Popism, not Pop to Popism, Pop to Popism. It opens at the Art Gallery of New South Wales this weekend and it will be on show until the 1st of March next year. Oh, so we've all got plenty of time to see it. I probably will get to Sydney before the 1st of March next year. On our end, this is Books and Arts Daily. Still to come, Sir Roger Moore joins us. He's played James Bond more times than any other actor. Zwischen den Gästen grünen Weiden, doch aus jungfrischer Mühe her. That's a little bit of Mahler's Song of the Earth, which is music set to German translations of Chinese poems from the Tang Dynasty. Now, China's always in our news, but I wonder how much we really know about its culture and its politics. Modern China is a bundle of contradictions, really. Its image is modern and slick and luxurious and prosperous, but it's also, as we know, a one-party state where people can pay a terrible price for speaking out. Nicholas Jost is a novelist, he's an essayist, he's a professor at Adelaide Uni, and he's the general editor of that massive anthology of Australian literature published by Macquarie. And he's got a long association with China. He's written about it in his fiction and his essays. And he's really one of those people who's helped the rest of us understand what's going on in contemporary China. His latest book is lovely. It's a collection of short stories called Bapo, I think that's how you say it, and it's stories that are all influenced by China in some way. He's also been reading a new novel, which is called Death Fugue, which is by the Chinese writer Xing Curie, who writes about the Tiananmen Square massacre in a very bold way. And Nicholas joins us now from our Adelaide studios. Good morning, Professor.
Hello, Michael.
How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Now, I think I first met you. I've been casting my mind back, and I think I first met you at ANU in 1980 or 81. And you were already sort of getting involved in Chinese matters then, weren't you?
Yeah, I was learning Chinese at the Canberra College of Advanced Education, as it then was, at a night school, for mysterious reasons. But somehow something in my bones told me that China was going to be important to Australia, and I wanted to look into that. And so I learned a bit of Chinese, and then my first visit to China was in 1983.
I can remember you doing this and thinking, this is just impossible, because Chinese, it just must be impossible to learn. I think if you were a small child, I could understand learning it. But it must have been an incredible challenge, because you were a mature person by then.
Yeah, people always say how hard Chinese is to learn. It's actually not so hard to learn how to speak Chinese. The writing is very hard. And if you're a Chinese child and you're just forced to do it through repetition, that's probably a very good way to learn it. My writing isn't great. It is the writing of a kindergarten child in Chinese. But I learned how to communicate in the language, and that was really essential for the period when I worked there in the late 1980s.
So you were a cultural counsellor. What does that mean?
Yeah. Well, I started out teaching, actually. I taught there for 2 years, and then I became the cultural counsellor at the Australian Embassy, a very august title, like the title of those courtiers in the in the emperor's
Oh yes, I'd like
domain.
I'd like you to meet Nicholas Jost. He's our cultural counsellor. Oh gosh.
But in those days in the Australian Embassy, it really covered everything that wasn't directly politics or trade. So that included the arts, of course, but it also included education and sport and animal exchanges and generally people to people exchanges, right, which is what I was very interested in.
I like the idea of you kicking a footy around in Tiananmen Square. I can see that, Nicholas.
I umpired a cricket match.
Is that right?
How do you know?
Well, I'm so sorry. We'll press on. So let's talk about this book. This is a lovely book, isn't it? It just looks gorgeous. It's got the most fantastic cover. So this word that's on the cover, bapo, what's that?
Yeah, it's a Chinese artistic term. I mean, the first half of it, ba, is the Chinese word for eight, which is a lucky number in Chinese. The second half, po, means broken or worn out, and it kind of suggests that the luck has run out. So it's a word of opposites. And in a way, after your luck runs out, if you can still survive, that's another kind of luck. So it suggests sort of the wheel of fortune. In Chinese artistic terms, what happens is that artists paint what looks like a collage of broken or burnt bits and pieces and turn it into something rather beautiful. And in a way, that's what I've tried to do with the book, by taking these short stories, these sketches, these different angles on China, and putting them into a pattern that doesn't tell the whole story, but maybe it has some openings into it.
It'd be good if you'd stop whacking that microphone there in Adelaide, Nick. We're all hearing you do that. It's an art form where it looks like a collage. It looks like a lot of stuff stuck onto the surface, but it's all been painted.
It's an illusion. by the artist. And so for me as a writer, that became a kind of an image for what I'm doing in these stories, where I'm staging or creating illusions of different scenes in China, or else transferring some of those aesthetic ideas into writing that's set in Australia.
We're talking to Nicholas Jost this morning, who is, he's a man who knows lots about China and a wonderful writer. And we're talking about his collection of short stories, which is called Bapo. And one of the stories that really caught my eye and that I enjoyed very much when I was reading the book last night is called Donkey Feast, which is about a group of friends who gather some years after their original gathering, and they've got a photograph that recalls the old days. Just tell us what's going on in this story.
Well, those old days were back in the 1980s, around the time of Tiananmen Square, when I was also in China. And these people have been involved with the arts. And over the intervening 25 years, their lives have changed incredibly as China has changed. And some have had incredible success. Others have disappeared. Some have changed their names and gone on to other lives. And so they meet up to reflect on what has happened to them in the intervening years. And for me, this is something that happens a lot when I'm in China, because in that time, Australia has also changed. I've changed. Some of these Chinese artists have come to Australia, and their lives have changed. It was interesting when you were talking about pop before. I mean, some of these artists were part of the Chinese pop movement that came to Australia in the exhibition Mao Goes Pop in the early 1990s. So they're gathering to reflect on what it means and what the losses over this period have been, as well as the gains. It's called Donkey Feast because they're taken by a very successful artist to a restaurant outside Beijing where they eat donkey meat. And the reason they're eating donkey meat is that all the other food they might eat is now just too dangerous to eat.
Everything else is considered toxic.
Yes,
everything else is off for some reason. So donkey meat is the food of choice. I can't imagine eating donkey. You explain that it has enormous bones.
Yes, and they give you plastic gloves to wear while you hold the kind of donkey shank and gnaw on it, you know, if that's what you want to do. But in fact, in this story, the very successful artist has now given up meat altogether.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
And is on a strict diet.
I like to think of myself as an enthusiastic multiculturalist, but I'm drawing the line at donkey meat. I'm sorry, but I'm not even going to try donkey meat. Now, what other story could we talk about? I do love the one about the academics who are on the tour. Well, there includes academics who are on a tour. You've sort of captured the characters of the various people extremely well. But let's talk just very briefly about Loving China, which is about an Australian couple who share a love of China. Why is this one significant to you?
Well, China becomes a big part of your life when you get involved with it. And it becomes almost like a partner in a relationship if you have a relationship with someone, as I do, particularly if they're also involved with China. So China is ever present, but it's quite hard to share that with the wider world. And for me, it's a bit of a story about how in Australia we have all of these connections with China through all sorts of people, but we still don't really understand. We find it hard to understand, and we put up various barriers in the way. Now, I'm not saying China is easy to understand, but it's kind of wasteful and even dangerous, I think, for the country when we can't use the expertise for understanding China that we actually have all around us.
Yeah, it's mad. It's absolutely mad. I mean, not just China, but, Indonesia. You know, we live next door to Indonesia and we know so little about Indonesia. And all we ever discuss is political conflict with Indonesia. You know, the cultural stuff is just not explored at all. Mm. Do you think it's changing, Nicholas? I mean, you know, I laughed about you learning Chinese back in the 1980s because it seemed so unfathomable to me. But when I meet young people today, it does seem that there are lots of kids who are learning Chinese at school.
Yeah, there are, but I think there's now a kind of tendency to think, well, the Chinese all speak such good English, let's leave it to them do the interpreting of all of this. That is one of the problems. I think also in some ways China's becoming harder to understand as it becomes more powerful. China is very interested in itself now. It's actually less interested in sort of learning from the West. When I was the cultural councillor back in the 1980s, we always got a very warm welcome and a great sort of participation in any sorts of cultural exchanges we did in Australia. That's not really the case now. People are not that interested. And so I think that also makes it harder to have a real flow of exchange.
Let's talk about this book you've been reading. So this is a book called Death Fugue. It's by a Chinese writer called Sheng Qiri, and it's just been published in Australia by Girimondo. So who is she?
Yeah, well, she's an absolutely remarkable Chinese writer in her 40s, and this is an extraordinary and important book. The reason why is that there's been almost no writing about Tiananmen in 1989 in Chinese. As we all know, the discussion of the topic is completely forbidden. And what that means is there's been quite a lot of writing from outside China and a lot of it in English, but it hasn't been possible for writers inside China to really go there. And the pressure has built up over the years. And now she has come out with this extraordinary novel, which uses satire and fantasy in an indirect way to talk about these things, not only what happened back then, but what the kind of repercussions have been over the years since.
Now, we've only got a couple of minutes, Nick, but so she's describing a sort of future society called Swan Valley, which I guess can be read as China in the future, and pregnancies that are deemed likely to produce children with low IQs are terminated immediately. It's this sort of world, is it?
It's a contrast between a humanistic China that was crushed in 1989 and a China of wealth and power and total control that might be now. But her image for Tiananmen is this giant pile of excrement that suddenly appears in the square in the centre of the city one day and provokes all sorts of concerns about the stink, and then it ends in kind of violence and disappearance. And then we return to this bright, shiny, luxurious new world. It's written in an incredible kind of filigreed but quite rough style. And for a Western reader, it's part of what I was saying earlier. It's a challenge to go there. It's a novel like nothing else, but it is an expression that's coming right from the heart of China. So for that reason, I think it's an important book.
It sounds a little bit like Brave New World, is it?
It has elements of Brave New World. It has elements of Viennese writing at the beginning of the 20th century. It has elements of Philip K. Dick science fiction, but it's also very feminist and very, very seductive. It's about seduction of different kinds, of the state through its propaganda, of noble ideals for democracy and change, and between people, men and women in their interrelationships.
So it sounds as though you're recommending this one, Nick.
It's a pretty interesting book.
Yeah, all right. Well, that sounds tremendous. And that's called Death Fugue. And it's by, what's her name again?
Sheng Qiri.
Sheng Qiri, which is spelled K-E-Y-E. It's just been published in English. And also, I'm happy to recommend your book, Nicholas. It's called Bapo, and it's published by Girimondo as well. Thank you for coming into the studio. It's been good to talk to you.
Cheers, Michael. Thank you.
Nicholas Jose. And these days, Nick is a professor of English and creative writing at the University of Adelaide. On RN, this is Books and Arts Daily. I'm Michael Cathcart. Next up, Roger Moore.
I spotted him heading south, and he was walking on the white line on the perimeter of the road to try and keep his feet cool, I think.
He owns nothing but a bowl, three robes and a blanket, and he sleeps nowhere in particular.
I pulled up and said to him that if he wanted a place to stay, come in. He's been walking all day. I'm quite sure he's not going to have the energy to get up in any trouble.
A day in the life of a wandering Buddhist monk. That's Encounter, Saturday after the news at 5, here on RN.
Yes, he's the man with the golden gun and the golden voice and the golden life, really. He's played the British secret agent James Bond in no fewer than 7 films. This was between 1973 and 1985. And he was also much loved, especially by my wife, I have to say, as Simon Templar in The Saint. And also he was in that series, The Persuaders, which he co-starred in with Tony Curtis. It's a very unusual thing to watch on video now or on DVD. It's quite quaint. He's also a Goodwill Ambassador for UNICEF, a role that he was introduced to by Audrey Hepburn and for which he was made a Knight of the Realm. Sir Roger Moore is now 86. He spends most of his days in Monaco and counts members of European royalty among his closest friends. In fact, he claims an Australian connection through his friendship with Princess Mary of Denmark. And it's his life among the glitterati that is the subject of his latest autobiography. It's called Last Man Standing, Tales from Tinseltown. It's about to be released in Australia. Suzanne Donisthorpe catches up with Sir Roger, who was in the London studios of the BBC.
Sir Roger, thank you for making the time to speak with us. It's a real honour.
Well, it's Roger, by the way. I dropped the sir.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I answer to anything except Mary or Sheila.
Oh, 007.
Oh, that's all right. They paid the rent.
It certainly did. Now, we're here actually not to talk about 007 entirely, but about your new book called Last Man Standing. And it seems to me this is a kind of quite poignant title because you have worked with so many people who are no longer with us. I mean, that must be quite tough for you.
Well, I remember years ago, was in New York, and Frank Sinatra, we were in a bar, and Frank Sinatra, where else? And Frank had come in from L.A. for the funeral of Bennett Cerf. And the same day, a mutual friend of ours died in London, and Frank said to me, you know, kid, I got to get older friends. I can't, younger friends, I can't, don't like the old ones dying. It's very tough when friends go. But then you have to look at the other side of it, which I say in the book, you know, it's going into another room and you just don't have the key to get in that room to see them. But one day you'll get the key. I hope.
There's been rumours that you've been dead too, I hear.
Oh, I die all the time. You should have seen my last play. But I started off being killed, I think, 40, 50 years ago.
Really? That long ago?
Oh, yeah. There was,
how did you die then?
I was killed in a car crash in France. Uh-huh. Another time, a horse trod on my toe when I was making... Oh, it was a... Yes, I played an Australian. It was... I was Marjorie Lawrence's brother.
Okay.
Marjorie Lawrence being you, the Australian operatic star who contracted poliomyelitis. And the beginning, the first scene of the film, I had to bring a horse out of a stable for Marjorie Lawrence to ride off for an audition. And the horse stepped on my toe. Ouch, I said. The publicity man immediately put a story out in the Hollywood press that I'd been trampled on by a horse. By the time the news reached England, I'd been trampled in a stampede, and my mother was on the phone. Roger, Roger, are you? Oh, you know how are you, my son?
You used to say, live and let live. You know you did, you know you did, you know you did. But if this ever-changing world in which we live in makes you give in and cry, say, live and let die.
Yes, indeed, rumours of his death have been vastly exaggerated. And his book is full of life. There are stories about the who's who of both Hollywood and the English Pinewood Studios, from the grand dames of the 1940s to the Rat Pack luminaries. In fact, it was Lana Turner who taught Roger Moore the art of the screen kiss.
We made a film called Diane, which is the story of Diane de Poitiers, who had been the mistress of François Prime, the King of France, and he engaged Diane de Poitiers to teach his lout of a son, Prince Henry, a few manners. she takes Lana Turner, as Diane de Poitiers, takes young Prince Henri, that was me, under her wing, and teaches him manners, and in the meantime he falls in love with them. And on the night that his father has died, and Prince Henri now is taking his father's place as head of France, and with Lana Turner in the moonlight on a balcony, I approached her and took her in my arms, and I said, you made me a prince, now make me a king. And I dived into her throat. And she choked. And, oh, she said, please, 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 please. And I said, what's the matter, Lana? Cut. She said, Roger, you're a wonderful kisser. But when a lady gets to 35, she has to watch the lines in her neck. So would you kiss me with all that passion, but a little less pressure? So I know I'm the expert on pressureless kissing. Well, in the old days, actually, we you know, there was no open mouth kissing. You know, the censorship that there was in America and the UK, that you couldn't, for example, be in bed with a woman, even if she was your wife. You always had to have twin beds. If you should sit on the bed, you had to have one foot showing on the floor, and both hands should be in picture.
Right.
I mean, really amazing. Today, they sort of, it looks as though they're excavating. They're likely to meet somebody coming up the other way. They go down so far. My wife goes, ooh, oosh, oosh. Oh, she's Swedish.
Does that slightly shock you that things have changed so radically in terms of protocol?
It doesn't shock me. It just bores me a little because there is no mystery.
Yes. Well, you, of course, come from the highlight of your career was in the 60s, the swinging 60s, where the sexual revolution was really turning the whole world upside down. So,
yeah, yes, the pill changed social mores.
Yes.
It didn't change Roger Moore, it changed social mores.
And Bette Davies liked to go to the dog races, you say?
Yes, she's an amazing lady. She came up to me, I'd never met her, and she came up to me at Elstree Studios where we were making The Saint, and she introduced herself. She said, I'm Bette Davies. She said, and I said, I know. She said that she and her daughter had watched The Saint, and then I discovered she was interested in going to the dog races, and so Bob Wagner, R.J. Wagner, and I took her to White City to see the dog races. She loved it. I loved it too, because every 15 minutes there was a new race, and you just sat at a table and a girl came up and took your bets, brought you your money if you won, and you also could eat. It was rather chic.
It's James Bond, and in all your films, you're a real ladies' man. You know, you're a very debonair.
You mean I'm a bit wet?
No. You're a, you know, a lover.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Because I couldn't kill anybody, so I just squeezed the ladies.
Do you think you can get away with that these days, or has pussy galore been liberated by feminism?
I'm too busy watching Daniel Craig's Bond, his moves, he is so good. I don't have time to look at the girls in it.
Oh, really? That's a shame.
Are they lovely?
Well, yes, but I think there's a sense that, you know, the times have changed now and you may not be able to get away with calling someone pussy galore.
Well, after one of the films I was in America promoting, and the lady said, are you going to do another Bond? And I said, well, at the end of every Bond, they say that Bond will be back. And she says, oh, so what does it say on this one? It says, Bond will be back in Octopussy. You can't be serious. I said, what do you mean can't be serious? Well, Octo, whatever you said. I said, what's wrong with pussy? This poor lady. She was absolutely horror struck. And I'd said it quite innocently.
Well, I must say you become more beautiful every day.
I am over here.
Well, of course you are.
And this is Miss Penelope Smallbone, my new assistant.
Miss Smallbone? What can I say, Moneypenny? Except that she is as attractive and as charming.
As I used to be?
I didn't say that.
Oh, you're such a flatterer, James.
Oh, Moneypenny, you know there never has been, and there never will be anybody but you.
You're very fond of Frank Sinatra. You tell some beautiful stories about you and Frank.
He was, you know, again, as I say, all of my friends were wonderful, and he was much maligned. He was very, very generous. He was very anonymous in what he did for people. I made a film in Belgium with one of the cast was Lee J. Cobb, and he said that a few years before he'd had a heart attack. And the nurse said, there's a Mr. Sinatra on the phone who understands you don't want to talk, but otherwise he'd like to say hello. So he said, well, of course I take the call. And Frank said, Lee? And he said, yes, Mr. Sinatra. He said, don't worry about the bills. They're picked up. He said, but why? He said, I picked them up. He said, but I don't know you. He said, I like your work.
Mm.
Was that wonderful?
It's very lovely.
But he did that. He did that all the time. Uh-huh. And he supported Ava Gardner right to the end.
Yes. He loved her, didn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah. I read that Tony Curtis was quite mean with his money, on the other hand.
None of us are perfect. Which, of course, is a line from the wonderful film he made with Marilyn Monroe. And,
of course, Some Like It Hot.
Jack Lemmon, yeah.
Tell us a story about when the carol singers came at Christmas time and you were having dinner with him.
My wife and I were invited for dinner at Tony's house with he and his pregnant wife, Leslie. There was the smallest chicken you could imagine. They get even smaller when they're roasted. And not only was this to be shared between four of us, it also is to be shared actually between six because there were two staff and they had to have a piece as well. And it was Christmas, and there was a ring at the doorbell, and outside went, God rest ye merry gentlemen. And Tony went and opened the door and says, go away, or I'll call the cops. And he was dancing up and down in his see-through caftan, screaming at these kids. But in some ways he was generous in scenes and acting with him.
Well, you worked with him quite a long time, didn't you, on The Persuaders?
Oh, yes, we were together for about 15 months.
Yes, yes. And Rex Harrison didn't like Julie Andrews.
Nope. Oh. Mm. But he was not at all popular. Christopher Lee told me a wonderful story about him. He said that when he was doing My Fair Lady in the theatre, it came out of the Drury Lane Theatre one night and it was pouring with rain. And behind him was Stanley Holloway and Wilfred Hyde White. And there were in front there was a little lady standing in the pouring rain. She said, oh, Mr. Harrison, you are my idol. You're the most wonderful actor. Oh, my God. Could I have your autograph? He said, you stupid woman. It's raining and I want to get home. Get out of my way. She was infuriated. She took a handbag and she smashed him right across the face. And Wilfred Hyde White says, well, that's the first time the fan ever hit the shit. I'm sorry you can edit that out.
Well, while Rex Harrison may have been less than lovable, for Roger Moore, it was Peter O'Toole he envied the most for his role in Lawrence of Arabia. It was a part that he wished he'd played himself.
Lawrence of Arabia, the greatest movie ever made, was brilliantly photographed, wonderfully acted, impeccably directed, marvellous script.
Mm. The film that you're particularly fond of, the one that you made, was The Man Who Haunted Himself, made in 1970. That's become a bit of a cult classic, I hear now.
I'm very happy about that.
Yeah. It was a small budget film, wasn't it? It would have been one of the smallest budget films you probably ever made.
It was a low budget film because all of us worked for literally nothing.
Mm.
It's interesting, though, that you still said that this is the one with the small budget that you feel most proud of.
Well, I had a chance to act in it.
So you feel that you maybe didn't get that chance playing the parts that you played?
No, well, no, there's not much acting required playing heroes. Not much dialogue to say either. My name is James or my name is Bond. James Bond. That's it. This is about the extent of it. Unfortunately, or fortunately, I suppose I looked a bit like a hero.
It's interesting that you should say that because, of course, everybody thinks the most marvellous role you could play would be James Bond. I mean, it would be every young man or young aspiring actor's dream, wouldn't it? But
You get to play with all the gadgets,
yes,
and all the ladies.
But still, it wasn't what you wanted, necessarily.
Not in that order, no.
Now, take a fountain pen.
Twist the top. And a highly concentrated mixture of nitric and hydrochloric acid dissolves all metals.
Wonderful for poison pen letters.
Pay attention, 007.
Sir Roger Moore, and paying attention to Roger Moore was Suzanne Donisthorpe. His memoir is called Last Man Standing, Tales from Tinseltown, and it's published in Australia by Hardy Grant. Well, that's the program for today. Remember, you can catch us online whenever you want. You can stream us, you can download us, you can say your piece, you can say, you know, give us your comments, and we'll put them online on the internet there. Now, tomorrow, it's the final Friday of the month, which means it's time for the European Classics Book Club, and we're going to be discussing Milan Kundera's The Unbearable Lightness of Being. So you better get reading, because you've only got 24, 23 hours now to get it read. Or you could watch the DVD. The DVD is a bit like the book. It's quite enjoyable in its own right. It's got Juliette Binoche in it, which is a plus in my book. But even if you started reading the book, you know, you would get the feel of what it's all about. And then you could continue reading it over the weekend. It's a wonderful read. The Unbearable Lightness of Being. We'll be discussing that tomorrow. And also, the Subcontinent Book Club is what we're doing next year. So I need your help to select the books that we're going to be discussing. If you click on the icon on our website for the Subcontinent Book Club, you'll find all the details there of what's going on. But let's talk to Cam about Bush Telly. What's coming up?
Michael, if I say name a superfood...
A superfood.
Yeah, can you give me one?
I don't know. Superfoods. What are superfoods?
Oh, you know, it's the marketing rage around quinoa and berries and chia seeds.
I love quinoa. That's why I'm so massively strong. That's why I fly to work, because I eat quinoa.
Well, we've done stories in the past about how the popularity of quinoa has affected Peruvian farmers. Well, there's another superfood called maca. It's big in Europe, the US, not so big here yet, but its popularity is having big consequences in Peru. We'll be looking at that today.
That's Bush Telly coming up after the news. This is RN. Bye-bye.
I'm a New Yorker. I'm able to ignore anything while I sit in the subway and read my newspaper.
Now as a 360 Documentaries podcast, living together in big cities and understanding each other through media.
You see someone, you don't phone them, and you don't walk around with it in your hand as if it's a life support system.
Passion. I think that's a beautiful way to think of media in our lives.
When I'm busking, I'm catching people in a moment of complete unpreparedness.
That's #city, #life. 360 Documentaries, online at the RN website.